books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I'm joined by Caroline James as we join the Cruise Club. We also hear about some self-help books from the team at the Happy Hour and find some new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On.
Before becoming a full-time writer, Caroline James carved out a fascinating path in the hospitality industry, owning a charming country house hotel and a lively pub. As a media agent, she worked closely with celebrity chefs, giving her an insider's perspective on the glitz, glamour and grit of the culinary world. Her best-selling book, The Cruise, has captivated ship passengers and landlubbers worldwide, earning its reputation as girl power for the over-60s. Her eagerly anticipated follow-up novel, The Cruise Club, is just out and is narrated by Patience Tomlinson.
A cruise is more than the start of a journey. It is the beginning of a love affair with the sea, where every port brings a new adventure. Carmen Cunningham fought the impulse to murder her mother. If Carmen's life was a novel, Betty Cunningham would have been edited out long ago, for no matter how hard she tried to please, Carmen could never satisfy the old lady's relentless demands. At 80, Betty was a force to be reckoned with. Despite pleading infirmity, she moved with surprising agility, and whenever Carmen felt the old lady's silver-topped cane prod into her arm, she found it hard not to snatch it from her mother's hand. It would be easy to pick up a cushion, hold it to Betty's face, and muzzle the endless nagging. For whatever Carmen did to make life easier, it was never to her mother's liking, and at times Carmen despaired.
"For heaven's sake, Carmen, can't you do anything right?"
Betty watched her daughter struggle with a laden tray.
"You know I like my tea at 5 o'clock, and you're 10 minutes late."
Betty's permed grey hair bounced like a cloud of silvery spaghetti as she snapped out each word. Carmen, named after her father's favourite opera, bit back a retort. Long ago, she'd learned that arguing with her mother was like trying to hold back the tide. Instead, she offered a placating smile.
"Sorry, Mum, I was busy."
"Busy? How can you be busy?"
Betty muttered. "Look at this room. When was the last time you cleaned? My asthma wouldn't be half as bad if I didn't have to live in a dust bowl."
That was a clip of Patience Tomlinson reading from The Cruise Club by my guest Caroline James, who joins me now. Now, Caroline, let's go back a bit to the first voyage of the Diamond Star. Let's, first of all, can you tell us about The Cruise?
The Cruise, it's about three Lancashire ladies who are in their 60s and they decide to go to the Caribbean, do something different at Christmas, and they set sail for 2 weeks to travel around the islands. And while they're at sea, they all have life-changing experiences.
Anne knew she had difficult days ahead as everything she'd known dissolved, and her chest felt tight as she watched Sylvia's carefree performance. But suddenly, Anne had a light bulb moment. The solution to her problem was obvious. As Sylvia's voice drifted across the pub, Anne felt a giddiness in her stomach. "Christmas is coming," she announced. "And instead of sitting at home watching the grey rooftops and drizzling rain, why don't we treat ourselves and book ourselves on a sunshine cruise?" "What did you say?" Jane reached for the wine, but the bottle was empty. "Are you serious?" Kath's jaw dropped. "I'm deadly serious. Anne straightened her back and turned away from Sylvia. I'll get around in and you two can whip out your phones and type in a Google search for Christmas cruises. Kath and Jane stared as Anne sashayed across the room. She suddenly had a spring in her step and stopped to chat with old school chums, occasionally nodding in her friend's direction. Damnation! Kath swore. She's telling everyone that we're going on a cruise. Kath looked down at the floor to hide her face. I haven't got over her telling Sylvia that I had a highly successful career in banking. Oh, you did? Sitting behind the cashier desk at Garstang Building Society for 40-odd years doesn't quite cut it in the world of global finance. Neither was playing second fiddle to all the movers and shakers I cooked for. I was invisible to everyone as long as my food preparation was perfect. She wants to go husband hunting, like Sylvia. Kath peeped under her fringe to see Anne order more drinks at the bar. I can't blame her, Jane said. She hasn't got much to look forward to. Anne tilted her head. But I'd put money on the fact that Anne would be the life and soul of a cruise and attract a man before reaching the first port of call.
It seems to have done really well, and I'm always trying to think, what is it that attracts listeners to it? I don't know if it's because cruises are very popular at the minute, but for some reason, this book does seem to have done quite well.
And you followed it up with the cruise club. It's the same ship, but this time it's not in the Caribbean, it's in the Med. Now, I hope you're visiting these locations for research.
Yeah, I certainly have. It's a hard job, but somebody's got to do it. And the cruise club, which is the nearest one, is actually based around the Mediterranean. And I based that on a cruise that I did. And I used the locations as well in that book. It's got a completely different set of characters, although one or two pop up from previous books. But this is about Carmen, who is a cozy crime writer, and she's got a mental block. She's got a bit of a writer's block and she can't meet her current deadline. So inadvertently, quite by chance, she sees an advert for a cruise to the Mediterranean. And what catches her eye is the fact that one of the speakers on board this particular ship on this journey is Ruskin Reeve, who is a very famous crime writer. And she thinks that by attending his workshops, it will inspire her to overcome her writer's block. But unbeknown to Carmen, who lives with her 83-year-old mum, Betty, who is quite a cantankerous lady, Betty gatecrashes the cruise. So it's all about what happens to the pair of them during the time that they're sailing around the Mediterranean.
As you say, there are characters that pop up in all your books. Have you got a little sort of library of characters that you think, oh yeah, I can put that one there and I can put this one here?
It's as if they seem to talk to me, Robert. It's as if they sort of say, me too, can I come on this one? The characters that reoccur in the cruise club are a couple called Fran and Sid, and they're from the French cookery school, which I'll talk about a little later on. A really lovely, warm couple from Blackpool, larger than life sort of characters. And it was great to put that. They've suddenly done very well for themselves and they've decided to go on a fantastic cruise and really treat themselves. So they appear on this cruise. But I do quite like bringing characters back from previous books. An author that I always admired enormously is Maeve Binchy, the late great Maeve Binchy, and she would write stories in Ireland about families around a restaurant or whatever. And when you read another book of hers, a cousin would pop up or a brother or an uncle or somebody, and I just thought, oh, it's like being reunited with an old friend. I always like that sort of style of writing.
Yeah, Dickie turns up in this one as well, doesn't he? One of the entertainers.
Yeah, Dickie Delaney. Yeah, he is the comedian, so-called comedian, who entertains the guests on the cruise ships. And he's a bit of a rogue, Dickie. He, you know, on and off stage, he's a bit of a rogue, but very lovable character. Several readers have sort of said to me, can you bring Dickie back again? But you'd need to read the end of The Cruise Club to see what happens to Dickie before we make that decision.
As though searching for inspiration, she looked around the kitchen at Desbet House and studied the 1970s retro designs. Bold burned orange was predominant on wooden cabinets and wood grain finishes, patterned shelving and countertops. She stepped across the vinyl flooring, which was dented by decades of pounding heels, then flicked a pendant light to illuminate her laptop, which lay on a formica table. Carmen found her glasses and placed them on her nose. She sat down, and as she turned the pages of a notebook, she wondered if she could place her lead character in a time capsule like this kitchen. Would the rainbow sleuth discover a victim slain by a Pyrex dish smashed into their skull, or strangled by the macrame plant hanger? Might the casualty slip on the contents of a fondue pot, or be chopped into pieces by the whir of an electric carving knife? If only she could find inspiration, glue her fingers to the keyboard and set the story alight. Carmen knew that she had to push her imagination. She'd led an ordinary life with little experience to draw on. Working in her father's hardware shop was hardly the environment to plot and plan a cosy mystery. Yet somehow she'd managed to write a novel that had sold well. The problem was in writing the next. Carmen dreamed of penning stories all her life. As a child, she spent hours cutting out images from magazines and adding text to make her own fantasy books. And at school, she bravely held up her hand when a career teacher asked the class what they wanted to do.
"I want to be a writer," the teenage Carmen announced.
But her teacher was dismissive and told Carmen that she didn't have the talent for novels and must apply herself to work in her father's shop. Carmen picked up a pen and began to doodle in her notebook. An image of her teacher hanging from scaffolding began to appear on the page.
"I proved you wrong," Carmen said as she drew a noose. "I wrote a novel and readers liked it."
Now, Carmen Cunningham is on the cruise because she's dealing with writer's block. Do you ever get writer's block?
Yes, I do. Yep, absolutely. I certainly do get that from time to time. And it's strange, Robert, when it happens to you, because you think you're motoring along nicely with the book. And then you sit down one day and it's just not happening at all, which is very, very frustrating. So I think everybody deals with it in different ways. All authors, some will just take themselves completely away from it. Others will just plough through until it keeps coming. I sort of have a bit of a toolbox to overcome writer's block. A book I read many years ago, which actually I didn't start writing till later life, and this book really inspired me. It's a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And it's for any creative, whether it's pottery, painting, writing, whatever. If you get a bit stymied and you can't go forward with it, she's got some really good tools in there. And then Stephen King, you know, the very famous author Stephen King has a book called On Writing. And if I'm struggling, I'll pick that up and just, he sort of really punches it at you, you know, sort of has some great tips to get you going. So that's what I tend to do. And hopefully it comes back fairly quickly.
On her 50th birthday, Carmen had experienced an epiphany when, following the sudden death of her husband, Betty suddenly sold their business and Carmen found herself out of work. Devastated not only by the loss of her dad, but by discovering herself at home with Betty all day, Carmen vowed that she would write her first novel. Her dad's words kept Carmen going through her grief.
"You've got to have a dream. To make a dream come true," Des had repeatedly told his daughter.
And we'll have more from Caroline James after we take a quick trip to the RNIB library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. For those who enjoy non-fiction, we have Eject, Eject by John Nicol, which was gifted by Simon & Schuster.
Thanks to the Pathé News films showing in Britain's cinemas, which enthusiastically reported their exploits to soundtracks of stirring patriotic music and clipped vowel voiceovers, a handful of test pilots had become household names, not unlike the first generation of astronauts or the Premier League footballers of the next millennium. They were an elite band, responsible for taking aircraft of the future to their absolute limits of speed, altitude and manoeuvrability, to evaluate the performance of man and machine under extreme stress.
Nicol tells the remarkable tale of how the ejection seat was first conceived during the Second World War, as countless lives were lost in accidents and in battle. In the wake of the war, that technological race to save aircrew lives using explosive seats continued at an incredible pace. Nicol tells the story of the brave men who risked their lives testing those early devices and interviewed the first British pilot to eject back in 1949, when ejection from pulling the handle to being under the parachute took 30 seconds. Today that figure is down to around 1 second. Packed with interviews from aircrew who knew exactly how it feels to bang out from an aircraft at high speed, both in peace and in war, the book gives the reader a vivid sense of what that life-saving experience feels like, but also features the moving accounts of what happens next from the viewpoint of both the crews and their families, who often have little or no information about whether or not their loved ones have survived, because ejecting is just the start of a journey.
I knew that a handful of brave chaps had made a couple of successful trial ejections from other aircraft in cold blood tests, but we'd not heard of a single one deployed in a genuine emergency. We had very little information about them, and I was very sceptical about the whole damn thing. Despite his misgivings, Joe sat down and then fastened the two sets of straps around his shoulders and thighs, one for his personal parachute and the other to anchor himself in position on the seat itself. In an emergency, the seat and Joe could now be blasted out of the jet together. The integral thigh guards should prevent his legs from being ripped apart on exit.
Eject, Eject by John Nicol is read by Thomas Judd and runs for 16 hours, 21 minutes.
If you enjoy a good psychological thriller, we have The Last Resort by Heidi Parks, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
Like every other trauma nurse, Raina is dead on her feet. She's been on them for the entirety of her shift and has clocked up another 23,000 steps. She had been ready to leave, but still the adrenaline hits her, as it always does. It's what keeps her going, even at 1:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning. She races over to the main doors of emergency in time for the ambulance to pull up. The doors swing open and there's a flurry of activity to lift the stretcher out. Raina glimpses the woman's face as she's rushed past. She's in a neck collar, intubated, like the paramedic told her. She'll be taken for a CT scan straight away so the doctors know what they're dealing with. Raina holds back for the police officer, who arrives within minutes. "I'm a nurse in resus," she tells him as she leads the way. He'll stay with the patient so that he has eyes on her. Then he will want to talk to the family when they get here.
Two people, two sides of the story. Whose do you trust? When Erin and Will start having couples therapy, they hope it will fix the rift that has appeared out of nowhere in their marriage. But their therapist, Maggie, can't work out whose version of the truth she can trust. Then Erin is brought into hospital in a critical condition following a hit-and-run accident. Now everyone is desperate to unravel the truth, because if this isn't an accident, then someone close to Erin must be responsible.
"Odd one, this," he tells her as they scurry along the corridor. "Looks like a hit and run, but God knows what she was doing out in the middle of nowhere on foot. Hopefully someone will have some idea." He waits by the doors to resus. He can ask his questions when the family gets here. In these precious moments, Raina knows the woman is a body to be worked on, to be cared for, a life to be saved. She shouldn't let thoughts of who the patient is, what family she has waiting for her, or whether they even know yet, catch her off track. But for Raina, that always comes sooner or later.
The Last Resort by Heidi Parks is read by Lucy Price-Lewis and runs for 9 hours, 29 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Escape into the world of great literature with Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, hear from a complete unabridged classic from the RNIB Library, beautifully narrated and specially selected for blind and partially sighted listeners. From timeless adventures to literary masterpieces, these serialised audiobooks let you enjoy a new chapter every day. And for younger listeners, don't miss Children's Talking Books every Saturday at 9 a.m. Perfect for the young at heart, and for sparking imaginations. Talking Books, every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, only on RNIB Connect Radio. And now I return to my chat with Caroline James. Her new book, The Cruise Club, is narrated by Patience Tomlinson.
As Carmen picked up the paper, a supplement fell out. Stooping to retrieve it, she saw that it advertised cruise ship holidays. The glossy brochure was colourful, and sitting down again, she idly flicked through the pages, imagining what it would be like to pack her bag and escape to a far-flung location. A holiday without Betty? Imagine! There were enticing cruises to the Caribbean, Asia, Antarctica and the South Pacific on giant passenger liners. At the same time, closer to home, one could enjoy a 5-city break in Europe. Cruising on the Danube, the Rhine or even the Norwegian fjords sounded fascinating. Carmen couldn't remember the last time she'd enjoyed a holiday. The annual pilgrimage to Bournemouth, pushing Betty's wheelchair along the promenade during 2 weeks in the summer, hardly made magical memories of sun, sea and shenanigans. "How I long for some shenanigans," Carmen said, as she stared at the adverts and exotic locations.
Now, we should mention your background. You said you didn't start writing until later in life. What was your job before that?
Yeah, my background is, well, I went to an all-girls grammar school and I always had a dream that I wanted to write. You know, that was my absolute dream. And my dad always said to me, you've got to have a dream to make a dream come true. And he had a lot of adversity in his life, from being a POW in Burma during the war to all sorts of things. But he did overcome his adversities. And I've sort of held that, you know, this make a dream come true. But when I was at school, and the careers teacher said to me shortly after I'd done O-levels, as they were at the time, what do you want to do when you leave school? I tentatively put my hand up and said, I want to write books. I want to be an author. And she just cut me straight down and said, you're not clever enough, Caroline. You will never be an author. You should consider a job in retail. So that was like a punch and it knocked all the confidence out of me. I thought I'd never write anything that anybody would want to read. And my career went in a completely different direction. I had a lovely career, a successful career in hospitality, from working in London for the Hyatt Group at a 5-star hotel. I actually had a pub in Cumbria for several years, Country House Hotel, which features in the books at some point. And then I was a media agent representing celebrity chefs for nearly 16 years. But I never lost my writing dream. It never went away from me. And of course, hospitality is like a revolving door. There's always different people coming through the doors. And, you know, I was always sort of got characters in my head. So in my early 50s, while I was still running the business, I thought, if you don't put your bum on a chair and start writing, you'll never know. And what's the point of that? So I did. as I say, I was still working, as we all have a lot going on in our lives, don't we? But I used to snatch hours early morning, late at night, and eventually I got a manuscript together, and that was my first book, which was called Coffee Tea, The Gypsy and Me, which, as I say, I didn't write until I was in my early 50s.
Before you got into hospitality, I think we had something in common. You had I had a misspent youth on a snowboard. You had a misspent youth on a surfboard.
Yeah, I did. I mean, when I actually really hated school. I mean, my two elder sisters loved grammar school, but I loathed it. I was quite bullied at school and I didn't seem to get on very well. And with the careers teacher basically telling me I wasn't any good at anything. Not only did I leave school, much to my mum and dad's horror, I also left home and I went down to Cornwall and started working in hotels and restaurants, doing anything really from pot washing, waiting tables, you know, scrubbing floors, whatever it took to pay the bills. But that's when I got my love of the hospitality industry. I just thought it was a fascinating place with such a stage of characters. And I said to my dad, I think I'm going to try and have a career in hospitality. And he said, well, if you're going to do that, you need to get some qualifications. So I went and did a catering course in Bournemouth, and on the strength of that, then moved up to London, and sort of that kick-started my hospitality career.
On a hot and sultry day in early July, Waltho Williams stood on the terrace of a shaded corner of his home, La Maison du Paradis, and posed a question. Would today, with the opening of the French cookery school, mark the first day of the rest of his life? Waltho raised his chin and thoughtfully stroked the newly grey tinge of neatly shaved stubble, a sharp contrast to his skin, the colour of night. Looking out to the garden, he filled his lungs with the sweet smell of wildflowers from a nearby border and watched the colourful heads sway in the warm breeze. Each petal created a carnival of colour against the rich soil, and his artist's eye admired their fluidity and beauty. Reaching out, he picked a sprig of lavender from wands planted deep in an old terracotta pot. The intense, heady scent, pinched between his fingers, jogged his memory, and a sharp pain stabbed in his chest.
"Oh, Lauren," Waltho sighed, "if only you had lived to see what you created."
His eyes were misty as the years dissolved, and he remembered the journey that had led him to this place.
Did your hospitality career and your later work with celebrity chefs feed into your book, The French Cookery School?
Yes, a little bit, because I kind of do know the business. It's probably in an earlier book called Coffee Tea, The Chef and Me, where I mirror the character in that is loosely based on Keith Floyd, who I just thought was the best chef ever, such a character. But the French Cookery School does have a celebrity chef in it. And the French Cookery School is actually based in a farmhouse in the Charente on the edge of the Dordogne. And what inspired me to write this book was that I used to do a press trip every April to this particular farmhouse because a celebrity chef that I represented ran cookery courses throughout the summer months. And I would go along with the press at the beginning of the season and they would experience the week so that they could go back to their publications and write about it, and that would sell the courses during the summer. So I really sort of knew this place very well, and it had been the former home, boyhood home, of President Mitterrand, and it was just a lovely, lovely environment. You know, you open the shutters in the morning and you get this gorgeous smell of lavender from the lavender farm next door, and you can hear the sunflowers waving in the fields and feel the warm sun on your skin. It was just a really magical place. So I took a celebrity chef and popped him in this for the French Cookery School. And then I just brought a cast of characters in for a week. And it's what happens to them during the week at the school. And they get up to all sorts of things, really. It was fun to write that one.
Gazing out to the garden, Waltho glimpsed a swimming pool. The surface water, unmoving, lay like a mirror beneath the sunny sky. His artist's eye considered the subtle light that changed during the day, creating an evolving palette of colour. It looked so cool and inviting that Waltho was tempted to strip off and plunge in. But there was no time to swim. A phone rang within the house, and moments later, Waltho heard footsteps crunching across a gravelled path. "Hey," a voice called. "Thomas has left the airport and is on his way." Waltho walked towards the woman who approached.
"Merci, Angelique," he replied. "Everyone will soon be here. Are we ready? As ready as we will ever be.
That's Jill Mills reading from The French Cookery School by Caroline James. Now, you've used Jill Mills for a few of your books. Did you have any hand in the casting of the narrators of your audiobooks?
I'm a mixture of an indie author and a traditionally published author, Robert. When I first started writing, the first book that I mentioned to you, called Coffee to the Gypsy and Me, I couldn't get a publisher or an agent for the life of me. I think after more than 80 rejections, I just stopped sending it off. So I ended up self-publishing it. And this was about 12 years ago, at a time when I could see that some people were doing really well with self-publishing. So yes, with self-published books, I've always had the choice. I've always had the lovely pleasure of listening, casting people and listening to them read episodes from the books. I now write for HarperCollins. I've been writing for HarperCollins for nearly 4 years, and I don't get that choice. I probably, for example, with the new book, The Cruise Club, I was given 3 voice recordings of different narrators reading a section of The Cruise Club, and it was for me to choose who I thought was the best one. Fortunately, the lady who reads it is Patience Tomlinson, and she's nailed it. She's absolutely got it. You know, I was delighted when I heard her reading it. She just jumped right out. The sound of her voice and the way she depicts the characters with her tone, etc., was bang on. So I was very delighted that the clever team at HarperCollins had chosen well there.
That's why we've got your books, because we have a deal with HarperCollins that give us all the audio versions of your books. So we've got The Cruise, The Cruise Club, The French Cookery School, but more of your books are available in audio commercially. The Best Boomerville Hotel is narrated by Penelope Freeman. The second book is narrated by Jill Mills. Now they are available in audio. They are available for anyone, for whatever reason, be it dyslexia or sight loss or whatever, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
It is. It's really important. Personally, I don't know anybody with visual impairment other than my mum. My mum's eyesight was terrible. It really failed later in life. And she was a great reader, particularly historical books. So I used to read to her out loud, and it was an important part of her day. You know, it distracted her away from the pain she was experiencing. She could then mentally wander through a lovely world of stories. So accessible reading, yeah, it's incredibly important to me, because I think stories are for everyone. And I'm really grateful that my book can reach readers through audio. I think it's wonderful.
Now, if we download The Cruise Club from RNIB Library, we will miss the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of The Cruise Club?
Yes, I can, certainly. I'm looking at it now, and it depicts 4 characters who are standing by the railing of a deck on a ship. So the background of the book is like a lovely blue colour of the Mediterranean on a sunny day. It's got white sparkles that suggest the sun shining on the sea. On the horizon, the sun's just setting. It's like a lovely rhubarb shade of pink. To one side, there's a little cluster of pastel painted houses, you know, quite Mediterranean. Carmen, the main character, she's wearing a white dress and a coral coloured cardigan, and she's sitting on a couple of suitcases sipping a cocktail. And Fran, she's another main character. She's got a lovely yellow dress on and the hem's blowing in the breeze. The Cruise Club, the title, is at the top of the cover, and there's a strap line there that says, "The best adventures are still to come."
Carmen felt her pulse quicken as she reread the advertisement. Her hero, the crime writer Ruskin Reeve, was a guest speaker on this Mediterranean cruise. It must be a sign. The famed Ruskin Reeve was her inspiration, and she had all his books in series order placed prominently on a shelf in her bedroom. She adored the crime writer, who wrote tales of intrigue and deception, and whose works had captivated readers and critics worldwide, gaining many prestigious awards. Carmen loved Ruskin's keen eye for detail and understanding of human psychology, creating complex mysteries and believable characters. The writing gods had guided Carmen, and now all she had to do was summon the courage to pick up the phone and book her place on the cruise. "If only I could write like you," Carmen breathed as she gazed at Ruskin's photograph, her fingers tracing the outline of the letters of his name.
Another clip of Penelope Tomlinson reading from The Cruise Club by my guest Caroline James. It's available in the RNIB library in audio, along with The Cruise and The French Cookery School. And many other of Caroline's books are available in audio commercially. And Caroline, thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you to the RNIB for all the wonderful work that you do as well.
And Caroline James will be back at the end of today's show for the books of my life. Now let's hear from Polina from The Happy Hour as we steer this cruise ship towards Norway, and she tells us about some self-help books.
It's time for a new self-help book spotlight. Now today we're actually going to mix things up a little bit, and we're going to focus on two titles from Norwegian explorer and author Erling Kagge. Now, Erling is the first person to complete the Three Poles Challenge on foot by reaching the North Pole, South Pole, and the summit of Mount Everest. And the first book spotlight from the author is his more philosophical release, Silence in the Age of Noise.
What is silence? Where is it? Why is it more important now than ever? Every evening I'd sit, puzzling over them. I began writing, thinking, and reading more for myself than anyone else. By the end of my search, I'd come up with 33 attempts at answering them.
Behind a cacophony of traffic noise, iPhone alerts, and our ever-spinning thoughts, an elusive notion, silence, lies in wait. But what really is silence? Where can it be found? And why is it more important now than ever? Erling Kagge, the Norwegian adventurer, once spent 50 days walking solo in Antarctica without a radio. In his meditative and surprisingly powerful book, he explores the power of silence and the importance of shutting out the world. Whether you're in deep wilderness, taking a shower, or on the dance floor, you can experience perfect stillness if you know where to look. And from it grows self-knowledge, gratitude, wonder, and so much more.
I was invited to give a lecture at St. Andrews University in Scotland. I was to choose the subject myself. I tended to talk about extreme journeys to the ends of the earth, but this time my thoughts turned homewards to that Sunday supper with my family. So I settled on the topic of silence. I prepared myself well, but was, as I often am, nervous beforehand. What if scattered thoughts about silence belonged only in the realm of Sunday dinners, and not in student forums? It was not that I expected to be booed for 18 minutes of my lecture, but I wanted the students to be interested in the subject I held so close to my heart. I began the lecture with a minute of silence. You could have heard a pin drop. It was stock still. For the next 17 minutes, I spoke about the silence around us. But I also talked about something that is even more important to me, the silence within us. The students remained quiet, listening. It seemed as though they had been missing silence. That same evening, I went out to a pub with a few of them. Inside the drafty entrance, each of us with a pint of beer, it was all more or less exactly the same as my student days at Cambridge. Kind, curious people, a humming atmosphere, interesting conversations. What is silence? Where is it? Why is it more important now than ever? Were three questions they wanted answered.
Now take a deep breath and prepare to find your own South Pole with Erling Kagge's Silence in the Age of Noise. The short title is only 2 hours and 5 minutes and is read by Atli Gunnarsson and can be found on Audible. Now, another title from the author, less philosophical this time and instead focused on travel and exploration. His latest release, The North Pole, The History of an Obsession, is available in the RNIB library.
I have walked, skied, climbed, and sailed in many parts of the world. I have been able to compare all the mountains, plateaus, forests, plains and oceans I've seen with somewhere else. But I have only experienced one place that is unlike anywhere else, the North Pole. Because when I finally got there, I realized there was no there.
Throughout recorded human time, few places on Earth have inspired as much fascination as the North Pole. This is an otherworldly place with no latitude and no longitude. A place when the sun rises and stays aloft for 6 months before setting and plunging the expanse of ice and water into darkness for half a year. Long before we ever journeyed to the North Pole, human beings have wondered what the northernmost point of our planet might be like. It became densely mythologized by writers, thinkers, historians, and philosophers across civilizations. Perhaps it was the actual Garden of Eden, or the sunny land of the Hyperboreans. Only recently did we get into the North Pole, fending off scurvy polar bears and frostbite to report on this strange, strange world.
The sun sets at the North Pole on 22nd of September, the autumn equinox, and appears again on 21st of March, the spring equinox. The geographic North Pole is the point that nations and explorers have vied to reach for centuries, and the point that, on my skis 20 years later, I was aiming for. It was only years after I got my first globe that I understood that there were, in fact, three North Poles, in addition to the one I would eventually reach. The four North Poles are connected, but each is very different. The celestial North Pole is located directly above the North Pole in a straight line, like an invisible continuation of the axis that runs from the South Pole through the Earth to the North Pole, and can, with good reason, be seen as the center of the sky. The magnetic North Pole has been crucial to navigation over land and sea since people realized that a magnet points north. It is a point of survival. The fourth pole is not so well known and has never been given a good name. I have chosen to call it the imaginary North Pole. It is not a physical place, but rather is a pole that exists in people's minds, inspired by Abenteuerlust, marvel, the imagination, and, on occasion, both oral and written sources.
North Pole, The History of an Obsession is available in the RNIB library, and the book is 11 hours, 28 minutes long, and is read by Atli Gunnarsson. To get your hands on this talking book, just visit readingservices.rnib.org.uk and sign up for your free account. For the first title mentioned in today's segment, you can find Erling Kage's Silence in the Age of Noise on Audible. Hope you enjoyed today's recommendations, and of course, happy reading!
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally on today's show, a return to Caroline James for The Books of My Life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Childhood, yeah. My dad was a great reader. He particularly liked poetry. And when I think back to some of the, and I think at school he had to learn poetry off by heart. So if he was sort of trying to get me to sleep, he would just sit there, well, narrating poems. A poem that I always remember, and I don't know how suitable it was for a child, was something called The Green Eye of the Yellow God, which is a poem by J. Milton Hayes. It was written in 1911. And I'm going to just quote you the first line of that, and listeners can judge whether they think this was appropriate for a little one. There's a one-eyed yellow idol to the north of Kathmandu. There's a little marble cross below the town. There's a broken-hearted woman tends the grave of Mad Karoo, and the yellow god forever gazes down. And I always remembered that, whether it was the tone of how he sort of narrated it to me, I don't know, but it's all about a young officer known as Mad Karoo who steals the green eye of a yellow god, which is an emerald in a gold statue, in order to impress his beloved, and he ends up getting murdered. So whether that was appropriate for a child, I don't know. But the Jungle Book as well, that was tremendous. I always loved the Jungle Book. I think Kipling planted one of the earliest seeds in me of my love of storytelling, you know, with the story of Mowgli being raised by the wolves and mentored by Baloo, and Dad would do the voices, and he really brought it to life for me. It was lovely.
It was 7 o'clock of a very warm evening in the Seeonee Hills when Father Wolf woke up from his day's rest, scratched himself, yawned, and spread out his paws one after the other to get rid of the sleepy feeling in their tips. Mother Wolf lay with her big grey nose dropped across her four tumbling, squealing cubs, and the moon shone into the mouth of the cave where they all lived. "Ah," said Father Wolf, "it's time to hunt again." And he was going to spring downhill when a little shadow with a bushy tail crossed the threshold and whined, "Good luck go with you, O chief of the wolves, and good luck and strong white teeth go with the noble children, that they may never forget the hungry in this world." It was the jackal, Tabaki, the dish licker. And the wolves of India despise Tabaki because he runs about making mischief and telling tales and eating rags and pieces of leather from the village rubbish heaps. But they are afraid of him too, because Tabaki, more than anyone else in the jungle, is apt to go mad. And then he forgets that he was ever afraid of anyone, and runs through the forest biting everything in his way. Even the tiger runs and hides when little Tabaki goes mad. For madness is the most disgraceful thing that can overtake a wild creature. We call it hydrophobia, but they call it diwani, the madness, and run. "Enter then and look," said Father Wolf stiffly. "But there is no food here."
"For a wolf, no," said Tabaki. "But for so mean a person as myself, a dry bone is a good feast." "Who are we, the Gidur Log," the jackal people, "to pick and choose?"
He scuttled to the back of the cave, where he found the bone of a buck with some meat on it, and sat cracking the end merrily.
"All thanks for this good meal," he said, licking his lips. "How beautiful are the noble children! How large are their eyes! And so young, too. Indeed, indeed, I might have remembered that the children of kings are men from the beginning."
The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Garrard Green. There are many readings of the poem The Green Eye of the Yellow God by J. Milton Hayes available on YouTube.
And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, there's a couple of books, so I'll make it brief. But there's two authors I've always admired enormously. One is Willie Russell, who wrote Shirley Valentine, and Arnold Bennett, who wrote a book called The Old Wife's Tale. So Shirley Valentine was sort of in the 80s, early 90s. The film was 1989. And I just find with those two authors, Arnold Bennett wrote in the early 1900s, The Old Wife's Tale was about two sisters called Constant and Sophia, and they had a draper shop in Staffordshire. And he wrote this book from a, as Willie Russell did, from a woman's perspective. And I've just, I just think it's brilliant how they do that as men writing as women. And I just completely fell in love with both books. I think with Shirley Valentine, Willie Russell probably inspired a legion of middle-aged women to head off to Greece, and whether any some of them ever came back, including myself, you know, it inspired me to do that. But The Old Wives' Tale with Arnold Bennett, I grew up in a town on the Cheshire-Staffordshire borders, and it's based in the Potteries in Stoke-on-Trent. The sisters live in a fictional town called Bursley, which in reality is Burslem, which is one of the five towns of the Potteries. And I remember as a child when the pot banks were still going, you know, there's very few left today. And when Arnold Bennett describes in the 1900s, the soot and the muck and everything else, you couldn't put your washing out on the line and all this sort of thing. I can really visualise it because I know those five towns really well. So, yeah, Arnold Bennett's book is a big thick book, and I can easily curl up on a sofa any time and reread that one again and chuckle away at Shirley Valentine as well.
Those two girls, Constance and Sophia Baines, paid no heed to the manifold interests of their situation, of which, indeed, they had never been conscious. They were, for example, established almost precisely on the 53rd parallel of latitude. A little way to the north of them, in the creases of a hill famous for its religious orgies, rose the River Trent, the calm and characteristic stream of Middle England. Somewhat further northwards, in the near neighbourhood of the highest public house in the realm, rose two lesser rivers, the Dane and the Dove, which, quarrelling in early infancy, turned their backs on each other, and the one by favour of the Weaver, and the other by favour of the Trent, watered between them the whole width of England, and poured themselves, respectively, into the Irish Sea and the German Ocean. What a county of modest, unnoticed rivers! What a natural, simple county, content to fix its boundaries by these tortuous island brooks with their comfortable names: Trent, Meese, Dove, Tern, Dane, Meese, Stour, Tame, and even Hasty Severn. Not that the Severn is suitable to the county. In the county, excess is deprecated. The county is happy in not exciting remark. It is content that Shropshire should possess that swollen bump, the Wrekin, and that the exaggerated wildness of the peak should lie over its border. It does not desire to be a pancake like Cheshire. It has everything that England has, including 30 miles of Watling Street. And England can show nothing more beautiful and nothing uglier than the works of nature and the works of man to be seen within the limits of the county. It is England in little, lost in the midst of England, unsung by searchers after the extreme.
Wives' Tale by Arnold Bennett is in the RNIB library as read by Eric Gillette. I had a good search but could not find an audio version of Shirley Valentine by Willie Russell, other than an old abridged version for sale on CD or cassette. Other books by Willie Russell, including Blood Brothers and Educating Rita, are in the RNIB library.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
I've literally this morning just finished listening to a book called The One by John Mars. And I have to tell you, I really could not stop listening to this book. I found it absolutely gripping and also quite chilling. The story is about a DNA test that matches you with your soulmate. So at first, what seems as the ultimate romantic breakthrough slowly unfolds through the narrative, different characters, and it can come at a terrible cost. What first seems to be a wonderful thing to do doesn't always work out as well as you initially think. The audiobook is particularly powerful because it has multiple narrators who all give a voice to a different character's story, and it really helped me follow the twists in each plot line and made that listening very immersive, you know, like hearing five dramas at once. Yeah, I really highly recommend that. I think John Mars is an incredibly talented author. So, yeah, I love that one. I'm going to download some more of his.
MatchYourDNA.com. Thank you for choosing MatchYourDNA, the world's first scientifically proven test, 100% guaranteed to match you with the one and only person you're genetically designed to fall in love with. With 1.7 billion people already matched or on our register, this is your foolproof way of finding the one. Your perfect match is just three steps away. 1. Sign up here for free. 2. Receive our free DNA test kit. Just send us the mouth swab in the provided container, and we'll use your DNA to find your match in our database. 3. As soon as we've found your match, we'll contact you. For a one-off fee of $9.99, we'll put you in touch with each other. 82% of customers are matched within 7 days. If you don't currently have a match, do not worry. Thousands of new customers join MatchYourDNA each week, and 98% of matches are identified within 6 months of registering. MatchYourDNA cannot be held responsible for any direct, indirect, or consequential harm related to using this service, including but not limited to dissolution of existing relationships, personal injury or death, not resulting from MatchYourDNA's negligence or misconduct. Full terms and conditions are available here.
The One by John Mars is available in audio commercially, as read by Claire Corbett, Vicky Hall, Simon Bubb, Jot Davies and Sophie Aldred.
Once again, Caroline James, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Robert. I hope that my stories bring everybody a bit of joy and a few laughs, and maybe a bit of hope as well. Thank you so much.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.